Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Hey, Thriving Farmers, Michael Kilpatrick here. So today's interview is with Ludell Steiner, who is the Director of Sales at Tilmore in Dalton, Ohio. Now, Tilmore is a marketplace for small growers where they develop, collaborate, source, and stock tools for the small farm industry. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
So talk to us, give us a little bit of an overview of the business.
Yeah. So as you already said, I work with Tilmore. Tilmore is a family-owned business here in Dalton, Ohio. And we as a family have been manufacturing, designing, and also farming for many years and have developed a number of brands, both for the agricultural purposes, but also in the lawn and garden industry as well. But about 6 years ago, we really kind of dove into developing tools for the market garden or the organic industry or the small farm movement, which includes a tractor and other implements and tools. And so we've been really intentional about engaging and identifying and working with growers around the country in our quest to discover the needs that people are having and identify opportunities that we can help serve them better.
Mm-hmm. So what was the change 7 years ago that said we're going to dive into this?
As a family, we really have had an interest, to be honest, on the international front initially. Uh-huh. We really have a heart and passion for working with countries around the globe, whether it be in development or agriculture, and having a farm of our own where we as a family test and run equipment over the many years also identified some needs as well and realized there's a missing link with manufacturers focusing a lot larger growers and oftentimes forgetting or minimizing the need to develop tools for the smaller shareholder grower.
Interesting. So talk to us about that international side. Are you shipping or are you starting to reach over there as well with this? Or right now you're just located in the US and North America?
So currently we're primarily located in our sales in North America. However, we have been testing equipment in Nicaragua for the last 3 years. We have two power units down there and a number of tools that are being tested with growers and agriculturalists there. And that's actually one of my backgrounds. It's kind of unique about me. I did spend 3.5 years in Nicaragua working in agriculture in the rural areas just really had a strong affiliation in developing and working with growers in those regions. So, yeah. We are intentionally working at that.
Interesting. Yeah, because one of the questions I had that my audience was asking is like, when are you coming to Africa?
There are some plans in place to continue our next steps around the globe. We're being very intentional about that and being very strategic about that so that we don't overstretch ourselves either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So talk to me about mechanical cultivation. I know since the chemical revolution, it was like just spray, spray, spray. But I feel like now everything is shifting back toward mechanical cultivation. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a multitude of reasons. One is customers are expecting a little bit more out of the vegetables they get. They're a little bit more aware of what they're getting and what they want. And so that's reaching back into the grower. I think another reason is, multiple other reasons. One of them is chemicals also cost money. There's a cost any way you do this. And so you can invest in tools and equipment, or you can invest in tools and equipment and the additional cost of the sprays and chemicals. So I think that's something that sometimes we forget. While spray seems easy, cultivation also can be done in a successful way. It just takes time.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe the third one is some of the chemicals that are out there, we're hearing more and more, do not have as good of an impact as the current are not able to control the weeds maybe as well as we would have, that some people would like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what you see too is like, if you use chemicals year after year, you'll prevent the weed seeds from germinating, but that's just mean they're not going to germinate. And the next year, if you don't spray one year, they just come out in a vengeance and you have a disaster on your hands. Compared to if you're doing mechanical cultivation consistently, you incredibly reduce your weed seed bank, and every single year it's easier and easier.
That's right. Yes.
So I think back to what you said is the customer is asking for, you know, organic, you know, IPM. So they're asking for that, as well as I think the farmers too are seeing some of the problems with the chemicals too on their land.
Well, the problem with the chemicals on the land, and also, you know, farmers are more, people are much more aware today than they were maybe before about, if I have kids on my farm, do I want them to be running a tractor that's a cultivator or a sprayer? What choice do I want to make? And I know that's something that people are more aware of. The things that we're using, the things that we're touching, the things that are getting in our air. And I think, as you also mentioned, as we see with our pollinators and some of the challenges there, and how that impacts, we believe it has an impact on our, those sprays may have an impact on our pollinators and what that can do and how that can also affect agriculture. So I think we're becoming more holistic as we look at the whole circle.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So someone getting into mechanical cultivation, where should they start? Because I think some people, it's completely overwhelming and they'll do it wrong and they think it doesn't work.
Yeah. So this is a really probably could go a lot of different ways. So I'm going to just touch a couple points. One, I think remembering when we start with mechanical cultivation, it starts before you actually cultivate. It starts before the seeds go in the ground. You know, it's having good bed preparation. Mm-hmm. It's having good prior planning so that your fields are in such a shape that they can be cultivated well, or that they're level enough, or that, that you have worked at some of the cover crops to help prepare the soil and get it friable and ready. So that's one of the things we oftentimes recommend, is thinking about cultivation even before the day that you're starting to cultivate. Mm-hmm. And then as we get more into the, okay, I got the seeds in the ground, it might even be thinking 1 week prior to the seeds in the ground. There's a process called stale seed bedding, or that sometimes is referred to, and that's a great thing to be mindful of, because if you can stay ahead of the weeds when they're in the small hair thread stage, we would call, or very early one leaf, two leaf max stage, then you're able to stay ahead of the weeds at the later term. So one of the things that can be done, whether it be with a flame weeder or a basket weeder or some kind of other stale seed bed, is before you plant, just run over the top inch of soil and disturb those weeds, so that when you plant, they are going into a stale seed bed, you might say.
Weed free.
Once then you have the point where the seeds are growing. Hopefully you get a good rain and you can get them up. You can come through, depending on what kind of plant, with some kind of blind cultivation or early cultivation. Once again, trying to stay ahead of those weeds before the weeds become as big or bigger than the plants that you are seeing as the beneficials. So I think those are some of the main points that I like to talk about. Mm-hmm. Even before we get to tools, is simply that whole process prior to planting and the early stages around planting. Because those are going to set you up for success.
Yeah, especially if you're working with some of the more difficult crops, let's say like carrots or parsnips or like onions. If you don't manage the weeds on those, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yep. So let's talk about the different parts of a cultivation system, because I think people say, okay, so what do I actually do? And how do I build this?
Yeah. I think depending on what scale, if individuals are moving from hand scale to tractor scale, I think you can think about a lot of the general tools that are developed for hand scale to begin with. So think about you have many people have seen or heard of a tine weeder, and there's ones by Too Bad Cats that make a nice pull one, or there's others out there. That would be an example of a tool that could be mounted on a tractor as well, a tine weeder. And so, similarly, there are flame weeders that can be done with hand or pushed. You know, there's a lot of good systems out there for that. They can also be mounted on tractors. So I know I'm not quite answering your question yet. I'm going to get there, but I'm just identifying that. Think about some of the tools you use. And so, similarly, hand tool that is like a stirrup hoe. Okay, how might you incorporate those? Can also be incorporated into systems onto parallel cultivators. And so those are the kinds of things that, as you think about the tools that you may use at a hand scale, are also adaptable often to a larger tractor-mounted scale. And so, as we move into a cultivation system, typically a cultivation system, once again, there's many cultivation systems. So you might have a flame weeder or a tine weeder or a basket weeder. And let me just hit on that first, and then I'll get to the final cultivation system. A basket weeder is a great tool that does a lot of, you can do either do stale seed bedding or can work in conjunction for between row and early weeding. And the way it works is there's two baskets, and the second one is driven, which helps does a better job weeding.
So they're basically with different sized gears. So the first one in the beginning digs into the soil, kind of breaks it up, but it spins the rear basket faster, which actually kind of spins the weeds right out of the soil.
Exactly. It's great for that early cultivation, stale seed bedding or early crops. And then now I'm going to get to the, I think what you're asking is more specifically a cultivator. So a parallel system that incorporates shovels or L blades or T blades or some kinds of knife system or an S tine, which has what we call parallel built into it. And so this allows it to float with the terrain of the ground, allowing it to always have good penetration and consistent penetration across the board. There's a gauge wheel up front or around the middle somewhere, depending on where it's at, that allows it to float and maintain a constant pressure. And then there are typically a system of whether would be shovels, knives, some kind of cutting system that would do the uprooting, and then also some kind of system for more of the in-row weeding. Things like a finger weeder that take care of the that work at taking care of the weeds in the row. And I always like to tell people finger weeders are only as good as we can get in there early enough to help work with the small weeds. So they're not a savior at the end of the season when the weeds are as big as the crop itself. So they can be a very effective and efficient tool, but they also have a really somewhat of a time-limited use in terms of getting in there when you can.
I think that one of the things I hear a lot of people say is you always want to cultivate scared. You want to cultivate when you think you're actually going to destroy the crop because that's when you're actually doing the most damage to your weeds.
Yes, and one of the things too, maybe that just to point out here, if people are haven't done a lot of mechanical weed control, we also want to do a little heavier population when we seed. Okay, so we know that we may uproot 5-10% of the plants. Okay, it will happen. We want to cultivate to such the extent that we will actually uproot some of our beneficials, so that we are not that we want to, but that we can be aggressive enough to also get rid of those weeds. And so if you're just going from a straight convention, you may want to look at increasing your population and a slight percentage points so that you can also afford to lose a few percentage points along the way.
Absolutely. So we've talked about a couple of the different cultivation tools. What other ones are out there that you see people using? You talked about the shovels, shovels, what are they mainly used for? Are those for pushing soil? Those are difference between knives and shovels too.
Yeah. So there are different profiles, and what most people might be familiar with is a traditional S-tine or Danish tine, and that's like a spring that has a conventional shovel, and those are just kind of really good basic systems. However, they would not be classified more, they would not be in the classification as a precision tool. So that might be good if you're just looking to go deep and do a good deep tillage or move dirt towards the crop base. They disturb more soil and tend to bury more weeds. Okay. However, as we've learned over the years and as we've continued to grow in all of our understanding, we're moving more towards more of a shallow cultivation where we want to not dig down so deep and keep pulling up new weed seeds, but work that top inch and a half layer. And that's where there are other types of shovels. They're more of a flat profile, an A blade, we might call. And those are designed to do more of a cutting and a tumbling effect, but not really dig deep. And so those can be mounted also on a spring or otherwise. There are we call L blades, or in our system we call them tender plant hoes, that are designed to have a cut, have a kind of a shield that's close to the crop, so you can cut away from the crop, and that's how those are incorporated or used.
And those are generally used early, and then later in the crop cycle, you generally throw soil back towards the crop, correct?
That's correct, and you can on our systems, you can actually turn those around so that the it's moving dirt towards the base of the crop then.
Nice. So you can the same tool will do both jobs.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the one thing about like those A blades, you like to have a basically no give to the shank on those. They're not on like a spring shank because if you sh push them back too far, they tend to just dig in too much in the front.
There's a lot of like with a lot of tools, there's a lot of different recommendations.
And again, this is like years and years and years and years of like cultivation that we're trying to cover here.
Yes.
So
So I want to be careful how giving explicit saying this is the way it has to be done. I know that there is a in Europe, a lot of times those A blades are put on a flex, but it's a stiffer one, and it's a little bit stiffer, so it doesn't give as much.
So it's just more like wiggling through the soil.
Yes, exactly.
All right. So we've got those. We talked about that. Let's talk a little bit about, we talked about the baskets. Let's talk a little bit more about the fingers, because I think people sometimes don't quite understand. And I think they're more, I'm not saying new into the US, but the rise of them has really been in just the last 8 years, I think, of people really starting to use fingers a lot more aggressively. Because you can also use those to cultivate plastic. I've seen you guys have some sort of system that you set those up to actually cultivate plastic. Talk to us a little bit about that. Because that on my farm was my biggest challenge.
So we heard that edge of plastic, and we also experienced that, and so we realize it's not just an anomaly to us, but also to others. Edge of plastic management is a big challenge, so we explored a number of avenues to how we could help address that. One of the areas that we kind of settled in on was incorporating our fingers into a multi-layered setup so that we could get closer to the edge of plastic without tearing the plastic, but while still disturbing that top layer, that crusted top layer where those weeds kind of just tend to grow, and then those roots somehow find their way around that corner and get down to where the water is, and eventually they become mammoth weeds. So if we get in there and just disturb that crust, it doesn't have to be really a cultivation, and that's what the finger weeders do in that edge. It's not really like digging it up, it's just disturbing that and breaking that crust more so.
And it breaks that root line with that big root,
Exactly.
and then the sun hits it, and boom, it's gone.
And it's gone, exactly. So that's what we're trying to do. Oftentimes we'll pair that with some kind of knife, or we also our Bezzariti spiders that we have, to help kind of give a help cut the crust as we get a little bit that's maybe 5 inches away from the edge of the plastic or 6 inches. We can break that crust with something a little stiffer. And then any of the in between row obviously can take care with an S-tine or some kind of basic shovel.
Yeah, I actually was using the Power Ox, and I kind of set up the similar to that with that for the edge of my plastic rows, and it didn't work as well as I would have liked because our soil type was too low in calcium, so it was kind of like it was really crusty. I mean, really, really like tight soil.
Yeah.
But I could see that once I get my calcium magnesium right, it's going to be a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and. Currently, we've used it most often with the tractor, and so we can get a good down pressure and be able to be able to straddle that row. But I definitely agree. If you have a really heavy crusted either clay soil or as you're saying, it can be too hard. Definitely, that there are limitations with any tool, and that would be one.
So let's talk a little bit about that, different soil types, because some people have rocks, some people don't, sand, clay. Talk to us about what you see people doing with some of those more challenging soil conditions.
Yeah. I think the most challenging soil condition to work with, and I'm sure people are not going to like to hear it, those that have it, but it's just rocks.
Yeah.
You know, any time that you have a golf ball-sized rock, or bigger, or fist size especially, it becomes much harder for the mechanical systems to help flow through. And I know some growers, they just have a lot of that. And so there are definitely some challenges. I think what I'll just share some of the challenges with different tools and how they deal with those.
Yep.
I think one of the things with the basket weeder, especially with rocks, is you may tend to bend a wire. That is not actually the worst case thing to happen. Sometimes we'll see the front wires get bent.
Yeah.
And that's okay. Don't feel like you have to bend them back right away. And you can bend them back. You just hammer them back and they'll go back. But it's the rear baskets that are the important ones. They're actually doing the weeding. So sometimes we'll see the front ones get beat up a bit more. But it still functions well. We have been exploring some options to work with redesigning our front drive on the basket weeder to address more rocks and clay soil.
Oh,
that's something that we are exploring. Yep. Don't have anything on the market yet for that, but we are aware of those challenges and are wanting to address those in the future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
With finger weeders, I would say if your calcium is not up to snuff or if it's a really heavy clay soil, it can be difficult for the finger weeders to break a hard crust.
Yeah.
If they are not paired with some other knife or some other system that's cutting the soil close to the plant.
Yeah.
If the finger weeders are then left to only deal with the last 3 or 4 inches on each side of the plant, then they can work. But if they're required as a standalone unit, it does not work very well. Mm-hmm. And then the finger weeders, one of the challenges with rocks is they will tend to funnel rocks towards the crop base. And so that's something that you need to be aware of, that they'll kind of gather that rock and actually move it towards the row.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say if you guys do have a lot of stones, and this is only for if you're on tractor scale, that the stone barrier tools out there, and there's several brands of them, they mostly come in from Europe. Those are incredibly effective just to basically push those rocks further down in the soil profile and allow you to keep that top couple inches of nice friable soil to get a good seed bed and then be able to cultivate easily.
Yeah.
So, that's a huge advantage. Let's talk about flame weeders. Have you guys done anything with flame weeders yet?
We have not. I know there's a number of companies doing that currently and are doing a good job with that and just have decided not to, at this point, pursue that.
Yeah. Well, there's a bunch of liability associated with that. So
that too.
Yes. So let's talk about some of the common mistakes you see. What do you see farmers, trying this for the first time or even who've been doing it for a while, what do you see the mistakes they're making?
Well, let me, if I can, I will answer your question, but I do want to just put it back. And where do I see people most successful?
Okay.
And I see people most successful when they're planning in their winter months, or taking their off season to be proactive and intentional about developing a plan for their cultivation. Okay. Rather than waiting until, because we'll get this as a supplier of components, it's surprising how many people are waiting to purchase products until they actually need them.
Which
I understand oftentimes may be a cash flow or maybe other things. And that's perfectly understandable. But sometimes it's not even that, it's just they may not have planned until that point. And so it's one thing to have the conversation back in December, January, February about what I need, how am I going to get it, where am I going to use this, and what's the strategy. And so I think those that are most successful have a plan in place for how they're going to do it, so that they're not putting out a fire when the crop is in the ground and the weeds are coming up and I have a problem now. So if I can say, that's where I see the biggest mistake is when we try to see a cultivation tool as a fire extinguisher rather than a safety and prevention plan, that this is a system that needs to be done and it's going to be required to do consistently. And then here's our plan for how we're going to do it.
Absolutely.
So I think that's where I would put the emphasis. But that's not to say, which we all know, weather plays a big factor in this.
Oh my gosh!
Best laid plans can be thrown out because weather, and I understand that, and I feel that, and I know that pain and that struggle. But I think if we can at least be proactive and understand what our strategy is, even if there's bad weather.
Yeah.
And how we plan for that, and know that maybe we plant if we know that we need to have at least two or three dry days, maybe we can't afford to have that, or we watch the weather and we maybe delay planting a couple days just to get that dry weather, so we're planting some dry ground so that we can also cultivate it. You know, it's having a little bit of plan and foresight into that.
Yeah. And the other thing too, I think, is actually getting out and seeing what other people are doing. And I know you guys do a number of field days and on-farm demonstrations. We'll get to that a little bit later, but that is, to me, such an important part. And it was such an important part of my journey was getting to those other farms and learning. I remember my mentor, basically when I was like year two, I was like, okay, I've got $5,000. What should I spend it on? And he was like, buy a basket weeder. So
I think you're right. The farming community, especially in what we're working, the groups we're working with, are so open and so willing to share knowledge. But don't wait. But they're busy too. So let's not wait until everybody's busy to try to talk about that information sharing. Mm-hmm. Let's be intentional about maybe pulling together and stopping by somebody's farm, even when there's nothing in the ground, and talking about their strategy. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, yes, let's go to their farm too in the summertime and see what they're doing and how they're managing it. But have coffee with somebody in the winter. It's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Lo, who are your mentors over the years?
Oh, I have so many mentors of people because I've been involved with so many different things, from agriculture to international development to business to family business to all of that stuff. So I would say you're probably wondering more specifically as it relates to agriculture.
Yes and no. This is a farm business podcast. So, I mean, I guess my question, I guess to kind of reframe that is, what were some of the things that your mentors taught you that allowed you to do what you are today?
Yeah. I think first and foremost, your question even revolved that asking about mentors is something that I think I have really found to be helpful. Mm-hmm. To the idea that I don't have all the knowledge that I need or should have, and that there are people out there that have experience and wisdom and that I can, and oftentimes people are willing and wanting to share it. What happens many times, people are afraid to ask. And so, as I said, I do have many mentors. And so I've international development, working with people in the communities before going and doing that, and talking with individuals about how to approach international development best, how not to do it, you know, and sage advice such as eat in homes with people. And I found that to be so important. And so in my work there, I would eat in homes with the individuals I was working with. And the sage advice of don't start a project in the first year. I'm going to help do projects. And the idea, wait, listen and learn first, then help and do second. And so my first year in Nicaragua was helping farmers in their fields, cutting their beans with hand, hitting, you know, harvesting them with sticks and planting with sticks. And as I talked and walked with people, learning with them, then I was able to identify, oh, here's some areas that we could help improve in the community. But it wasn't until we walked and talked together that we truly could understand together. And so that's just advice that mentors have given me, and I've listened to and I found to be very beneficial. I had a mentor for a number of years that worked works with a family business that has worked with me as we talk about family businesses. And so we primarily talk about family business, how to work in a family business and work in a healthy way and how to communicate well and do all of that. So I could go on and on. And I think the other thing too is I've had mentors for different seasons in my life. Knowing that our seasons change. And so maybe a grower was doing 1 acre 5 years ago, but they're wanting to get into 15 acres now, or they're, you know, 5 and 10. And it may be that it's okay to say goodbye to that mentor they had at the very beginning and welcome a new mentor. That could help them at the next scale and know how to graciously move on. And do that well. And I've done that. It can be actually daunting to have too many mentors that are not helping with you where you're at in your season in life.
I think what you said there was incredibly important, because I've, as likewise, had very many mentors over the years in my farming and life. And you're right. I've had to say goodbye to some of them because they didn't have the same vision for my life that I did, as well as they didn't have the experience I needed for that next stage.
And it's not that you can't be friends, but let's not invest a lot of energy into that relationship in a way that we may not begin what we need out of it.
Yeah. We're not doing the weekly phone call anymore. We're more just catching up once in a while.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that was good. That was really good. And with that, I'd like to stop here and take a quick break. In a minute, we'll be back with the rest of the podcast. If you've been enjoying this episode so far, you're going to want to head over to growingfarmers.com/free resources and download our free resource bundle to help you shave hours off your week and become a thriving farmer. It includes resources such as our 10 winter growing secrets we wish we knew when we started, which is a ebook which talks about the tips and techniques to get better growth in your winter production. We teach things like the simple but counterintuitive principle that trips up most beginning growers, the shape and size of tunnels that are best for winter production, how to prepare beds so they are weed-free and get beautiful lush stands of crops, what to do about pests like aphids, voles, and slugs, how to fast-track your research to fine-tune your production for your microclimate, and how to pack in more crops for higher yields and profits. So head over to growingfarmers.com/free resources and download your free resource bundle today. Hey, we are back and talking all about cultivation and business. So talk to us a bit about your team, because you guys have built an amazing team to launch this brand and to just now build this brand out. How do you find those people?
Well, I think you're right. We do have an amazing team, and I don't want to give credit to the credit goes to the whole team. But I will say a couple things. We as a as I stated earlier, we are a family-owned business. And so one of the first and foremost things I believe that is important in creating a good business and a good team is that the family itself is able to work and function well together and lead together. And we have been intentional about that. Yes, we have our differences, and yes, we have our challenges. And like any relationship, you will have that. But we have really been intentional about spending time together, doing things together. And when we do have challenges, addressing them and working through them in the best way possible. And so I think that that first and foremost needs to be part of that equation, especially in a family-owned business when you have many cousins and uncles and working together, that we work at that together so that we are healthy. I think another important piece is putting people in place to lead that are qualified to lead, and empowering people to lead when you have given them permission to lead, rather than undermining them. And so there are obviously some times where we may have differences and we need to talk through it. But let's talk through it and work through that and give people the authority and in the permission to lead where they're at.
So you're saying if you've given someone basically, hey, we want this done, you're kind of stepping back and giving them the freedom to figure out how to do it rather than micromanaging them through the whole process.
Yeah. I think everybody wants good direction, or most everyone's good direction. So if we fail to give good direction to begin with, then we may get a poor response. And then that's where people feel they have to micromanage. So the best we can do to give good direction in front, instructions of, hey, this is where the intended outcome, here's the timeline, here's what we want to see happen, then we shouldn't feel like we have to micromanage the process.
Yeah. Yeah, if the upfront is clear, and then you check back for the milestones of when they should be completed.
I think the other thing that we've done is we worked really hard at culture in our business, in our community. And what does that mean specifically? That's always kind of a nebulous idea as culture. And I'm not quite sure what it means every day, but I'll give some examples. The CEO, my uncle Dallas, and one of my other uncles who's an engineer, Roy, oftentimes will spend time walking around the shop floor with people and getting to know people and knowing names and knowing what's happening with individuals, and asking questions. That's a piece of culture that we feel is important. So how do we help connect with individuals? And so I would say caring about them. Another area about culture that we do is we're intentional about, working with individuals in our organization to help develop them. So we've done trainings, development experiences, or get to know you lunches together. So maybe different departments get together and come together and talk and have a meal together. So there's a lot of those intentional pieces that we do to create a culture that is positive and family oriented. So those are some of the things. I know that we also, as a company and as a business, have successfully incorporated a profit sharing at the end of the season.
Oh, very cool.
And so that's another area that we are able to help people who make the difference and who make the change also reap the reward.
Yeah. Because if there's nothing to strive for, they're just going to show up and do the same thing over and over. Yeah.
So those can be done different ways in different capacities, but letting people know that the job they're doing is important and finding ways to work at that culture.
Yeah. How do you share that vision? Because I feel like with this company, it's a little bit different than some of your other companies. And I think some people have a hard time understanding exactly what you're doing probably from the outside.
Share which vision? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the vision for creating a company that helps farmers with cultivation.
How do we share that with our employees or with?
Yeah, with your employees. Yeah.
Okay. So we We have a dedicated group of Tillmore individuals that have been hired on specifically to work with Tillmore. And so there's a group of us that our job is Tillmore. And so we will work at that both from the getting people on the seat of the tractor in the fields and the farm. Yep. So we have a farm that we have. And so whether you're a salesperson or engineer or a purchaser, we will allow them to test our equipment, run the equipment that we're both developing and selling and designing for. So maybe they don't all have a specific background in this, but really incorporating that into that. We also have a yearly, summit where we come together and we bring growers to our facilities.
Okay.
And then it's more of a mutually, where we come together, we talk tools basically.
Okay.
So we bring all of the Tillmore team out and we bring all of the farmers that want to come and talk tools, both tools of the past, tools of the present, and tools of the future. And we get everybody in the same room and talk. And that's a way for us to connect with the vision and help everybody connect more fully.
That is really good. Let's move on to your marketing. So you're just a new brand on the market. There's obviously some competitors out there. Where are you spending your time and effort now in promotion?
So I don't play a very strong role in the marketing. So I'm going to speak more from secondhand experience.
Yep. Okay.
That would be more of a question for Dustin. But I do know a little bit about what it is. And I'll speak more from the way I see it.
Okay.
The way I see it is, it's relationships. You know, like anything, if I'm growing a vegetable and I've developed a relationship with a local restaurant, that relationship is part of the marketing and being intentional about those relationships as best as we can. We all have a limited amount of time, so it does become a challenge, but being willing to have a conversation with people. And so I know I'll get some emails or calls. Can you do a field day here or there? And sometimes we can and sometimes we can't, but allowing people to know that we are interested in it. We may not be able to do it because of such and such a reasons, but it's not that we don't think it's important or don't care. And so I would say relationships is one of the things that we strive for. What your prior question is more around is what approaches do we take actively to market our products in a strategic way? Shows and field days is one area so people can test drive or see the equipment is important to get in front of people. Another area is getting in front of people on social media and also online through Google Merchants. And so we do work at that intentionally and try to make so that we're available to do that and get in front of people. And by having an online e-commerce site available 24/7, that in itself is a marketing tool, okay? So that it's working even when we're not able to work. We've worked really intentionally about that website as best as we can so that that can be a good face so that when people come to us, they have a positive experience.
Yeah. And I'm just going to pipe up right there and say, you know, a lot of these other cultivation companies, they say, oh, you know, if you call us, we can, you know, do this. We can send you some information about what this actually is. But being able to just go to Tillmore, is it tillmore.com?
Yes, sir.
And just click through and look through all the different things you offer. That makes the farmer's life so much easier because now they feel like they're educated when they get on the phone with somebody.
Yeah.
And I know from selling at farmer's market, so often people just are embarrassed because they're not quite sure what something is or how to use it. And they don't even want to talk about it. So having that out there for people just be able, and that you can just order online too, makes it so convenient. Cause I know farmers are frequently, you know, doing this kind of ordering and stuff late at night and they don't have time to pick up the phone during their office hours because that's when they're out working in the field.
That's right. Yeah, you're right. And it's not that we don't want to talk to people. We're more than happy to have that conversation, but we want to give people multiple opportunities to engage with us at different levels, at different times, in different ways.
Let's talk a little bit about the field days because you have quite a list of places and the conferences you're at. Is there a list on your website or on your Facebook?
There is a list on our website under Connect with Us.
Okay.
We are getting to the end of the season of the shows.
Yep.
I believe we'll be at two more here yet, and Moses and Oak. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be closing down on those. We're going to be moving into our summer kind of field days. And I'll be very honest, we don't have that schedule up, nor do I have a strong sense right now of exactly where those all will be yet. We have a number of candidates, mm-hmm. and actually looking to head to South Carolina towards the end of March,
okay.
For demonstration down there. If there's any of your listeners that are on the way from Ohio to South Carolina, wants to stop by, I may be able to do that.
Okay.
and that conversation came out of, there was a group of farmers, actually on St. Helens Island that I met at the Georgia show
okay.
conference, who said there was enough growers in one area that said, we are enough interested in your tractor and equipment. We would love for you to come and demo it.
Yeah.
And I said, I think if there's enough interest to, you know, to go to South Carolina, maybe a little bit of a challenge just for one grower, but you know, with a co-op of five, yeah. 10 growers, that's something that we are able to look at more specifically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, we have a quite a sizable list now. So when that is finalized, if you do have the information now, we can add it to one of our emails to kick it out. So more people can see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a weekly newsletter that goes out, that obviously with a weekly podcast episode. And if people aren't on that, definitely go to thrivingfarmerpodcast.com and just, there's boxes all over. You can input your email. But yeah, I mean, we're always interested in adding more things to help farmers thrive on there. So yeah. And so you also do, like, there's a couple big cultivation days too. I know, like, the Midwest cultivation.
Yes.
That comes,
yes.
Is that September?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm not able to give hard dates right now, unfortunately, Michael. But we will try to have those up on our websites here as we can. And then as we move forward,
yeah.
Check us out.
And that one is not to be missed just because of the extent of the level of expertise there, the number of growers that attend.
Agreed.
Yeah. So definitely want to get yourself there. Let's talk about, you work with a lot of farmers. You see a lot of different farmers. What do you think is the biggest mistake that beginning farmers make?
Does this farmer have lots of money or no money?
I think that's part of the question.
So if this farmer is a beginning farmer and has lots of money, I see oftentimes the biggest mistake is throwing too much money at things and not starting simple and basic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, I'm going to jump into farming and I have enough money to buy a lot of things that I think I might want or that everybody's telling me I need, and not really taking the time to evaluate what are the core things that will help them be most successful.
Yeah.
Okay. If this farmer has very little money and wants to get into it, I think it does create some challenges. But there's so many barriers at that point. Because the capital may not be there to do the things that you need. What would I say is the biggest mistake? I don't know.
Would you say not having the proper resources at that point? So not having like some sort of backing or capital or even like being able to get a loan to actually.
Yeah. I would say that definitely is a challenge. I think at that point, hopefully they have some experience, and if they've identified some of the main tools they need and some of the things that they can work at, mm-hmm. and be able to go in that way. Maybe what I will say is I know from sometimes when I've worked with individuals, let me give them one specific example. When resources are tight, sometimes then it's buying the least expensive option for a tool or a system. And this can sometimes get us in trouble too. It may not be that you need to buy a new Tillmor piece, but it might be, for example, I know one person who bought a cub.
Yeah.
The cub was not set up for the cultivation setup, so they couldn't even put any cultivators on it.
Yeah.
So they found an inexpensive cub, but then I said, unfortunately, I can't help you with any tools because it doesn't have the cultivators, the underbelly,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
So now
yeah.
Now they put out $2,000 and we didn't start with the right system,
mm-hmm.
but now we're unfortunately not even able to help. And they have to figure out how to do something with an inexpensive tractor they bought that wasn't even the right piece.
Yeah.
So I think thinking through that a little bit more might be helpful.
So start with your end in mind and kind of work backwards instead of just seeing a cute tractor, which Cubs are super cute.
Oh, they are.
Very unfunctional sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and they can be functional, but there's a very critical piece there that they need to have.
Yes, yes. With those cultivators, which I think when we set ours up, we had to ship them from halfway across the U.S. or something like that to get that those belly mount cultivators set up on there. So.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could pick one, what would you be your favorite farming tool?
I asked this question yesterday by somebody, and I had to think about it for a little bit. And I think I'll be on, they're all interesting. They're all fun. If I'm thinking more specific for vegetables and mechanical weed control, it is probably the basket weeder. Mm-hmm. It is just how basic and simple it is. How functional and timeless it is. Mm-hmm. How it's just a fun tool to say, wow, that's a great idea that's been built for the last 60 years.
Yeah.
And it still is a mainstay on many farms today and is a fun one to run.
Yeah.
And you can use it slow or fast, and it doesn't take a lot of experience. That's kind of why I like that one.
It's very versatile.
It's very versatile.
Yeah, and you can steal bed with it too.
Yes, exactly.
Which is very nice. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the Tillmore line, because I know you've got a number of different, like the different power units and stuff out there. So kind of share a little bit about, you've got the tractor, you've got the two-wheel tractor.
Yeah. So I'll try to keep this brief, but I may digress a little bit. So the tractor, we obviously, if you've seen it, is a little bit falling off of the Alice Chalmers G. In the process of designing it for the last number of years, we really worked hard to identify the things that went well with the G.
Yeah.
But also improve on the areas that we could, and such as giving more clearance under the belly, making sure that there was still full visibility for the operator and the tools, trying not to extend the wheelbase much more than we had to, keeping it short, but still giving maximum space. And so you'll see a little different design than the G on that area.
Yeah.
We also wanted to make sure the wheels were adjustable from 50 inches on center out to 78 inches on center, allowing a diverse number of growers to utilize it.
Yeah.
We went with an all gear drive drivetrain, allowing for maximum efficiency, allowing for long life as well.
Mm-hmm.
We worked at designing in the safety features so that you can have a range of operators use it and know that they are using it and will be safe on it.
Yeah.
And we also worked at a number of the service function and features, whether it be using a sealed wire harness, automotive style wire harness for long life to limit against dust and moisture. A lot of those little things that people may not observe or notice, but that are important things that we've went through the process of designing it with.
Yeah. And I think you've got a charger for your cell phone on there too. So
there is a USB port as well.
And we do have a video that I think I shot with Dustin at the New England Vegetable Growers that we will post right below the show notes here. So you can get, I think, Dustin walking you through the entire around the tractor and why they made the features the way they did. Another thing I really love about it is how easy it is to take the implements on and off.
Yes, the hoist system and having that be designed in such a way with a quick latch system for the lift arms, and then also the top link off the side, so you can easily pull off the implements either with your own hoist in your garage or with the hoist that can be built onto the tractor.
And then you have the Power Ox. Talk to us about that.
So the Power Ox, I just maybe give a little bit of backstory on that. We as a company, once again, have really worked intentionally at not necessarily duplicating what everybody else is doing, but just making sure that we're doing things intentionally that there's a need for. And so the Power Ox really goes back to, once again, to the 40s and 50s when there was a lot of cultivation, walk behind tractors, the David Bradleys, the Simplicities, the Planet Juniors that some of your listeners may be aware of, which those were great systems and great tools, and many of them are still around. And many growers, that may be one of your first systems that you should buy is an old Planet Junior and retrofit it. I mean, they're good systems. Unfortunately, none of those businesses exist anymore.
Yeah.
They no longer make equipment anymore, no longer are parts made for those anymore.
Yeah.
And so we, at one of our events about 2 years ago that I mentioned earlier, where we bring growers in, some of the growers really pushed us hard about making a walk behind.
Yeah.
And we pushed back a little bit, asking them, well, why would we do that when there's other good companies like Grillo and BCS out there that, who are already doing good work? We don't need to recreate that wheel. However, once again, the growers pushed us. Oftentimes, I don't want to limit them, but oftentimes those are more focused for tillage or mowing or tilling. Mm-hmm. They can be used for other cultivation setups. However, that was not their original intent, and may not be as designed for that. In other words, the clearance is not quite as much to go over the crop, and the pin where the tool's attached to need to be closer to the axle. And so the growers really pushed us on this to really develop our own walk behind. And that's where that's where we started off with.
Yeah, and just the number of feature upgrades you guys did. I'm blown away by how fast you were able to completely design and build and get it into production. And I actually got a unit that you loaned me to play with. And just some of those features are great. Mm-hmm. So just that speed of innovation you guys did for that was fabulous. And it made it so much easier. And I think a lot of people say, yes, I'll start with an older one because it's cheaper. But there are some major reasons for going with a new piece of equipment.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, we used to have Super C's. So our farm, our cultivation systems all were rotated around Super C's. But we literally every month or maybe every 4 months during the summer had our mechanic out to fix something on those older tractors, which meant that we weren't cultivating at the prime time, which meant that we had more hand weeding, which was incredibly expensive to do. So having a new equipment that you just basically pull the rope on the power ox and that thing fires right up and you're out and making stuff happen is so key.
Yeah. I do want to highlight, I'm not quite sure if you're going to ask about this, but I'll just mention it in addition. So we do have the power units. We also have tools that are designed to go on our power units, but also can be adapted to other systems. So for example, we have some of our hitch system for our power ox is the same as a Planet Junior. And so if you're looking for a toolbar for the Planet Junior, you could get our toolbar. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, if you have tools for your Planet Junior, they can go on to our power ox.
Yeah. To follow up on that, you guys on your website, you just have the a la carte feature, which they can buy so many things for cultivation.
Yes.
And I'll probably offend some other cultivation companies, but I think it's the best, easiest way to purchase that. It's all sitting there. You can just go look at it and then obviously call you guys for some of the more nuanced aspects of that. So talk to us a little about, you work with Ryan too out of Canada.
Yeah.
Talk to us about your relationship with them.
So Ryan Thiessen is in Ontario and is a tool maker. He's a farmer by heart and by trade, but also a tool maker. We got to know him, I would say, 2 years ago now, really have developed that relationship with him, and has been a good one in the sense that he has helped build equipment that we sell. He sells in Canada, but we also now sell in the US on our website, and good quality equipment that he's designed and built. And so that's been one of the aspects of our relationships. Mm-hmm. Another aspect is some of the collaborative work we've been doing together. Try not to necessarily overlap, but rather identify areas that we may not have the time to make something and just saying, Ryan, mm-hmm. could you make this? Or, or Ryan making suggestions for us on the tools that we make, how we can improve. So we have a very open relationship there and how to collaborate together and work together and encourage one another.
Yeah.
And then he's also, for any of your listeners who are in Canada, he is our main distributor in Canada. And so he carries our full line of Tillmore products in Canada and can help you purchase those there, and we'll support those in Canada as well.
Very cool. So what would you say sets Tillmore apart from the other cultivation companies out there?
I think you already almost mentioned it. One is, I believe one of the things that sets apart is our openness in our distribution form through our website and through our transparency on prices and also our customer support and being as transparent as we can about where things will work and where they may not work. Mm-hmm. And our ability to stock product, have it in stock as best as we can, and to ship product in 2 to 3 days, oftentimes just 1 to 2, but I think 1 to 2. And so be able to ship stuff out, get stuff delivered. Our support, we have staff that's dedicated to support. And so we do know that things may go wrong or will go wrong. And we do want to hear about those things. So if you have an issue, we are here to listen and we are here to help correct the mistake that if we made, or help something that happened in the field that maybe wasn't our fault, but that we can help you get going again. Mm-hmm. And so I think by our dedication, both in resources to inventory, resources into people to help support the product, and resources into getting it right up front as best as we can, rather than pushing things too quickly and too early.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm just going to follow up on that. You know, a number of years ago in our farming career, we ended up buying a very expensive piece of specialized piece of cultivation equipment from a company. And, you know, got it here, got it set up, was so excited, and literally was so disappointed that first day of running it, and ended up calling the company. And we're like, hey, you know, this is not working. You know, these are problems we're having. And they says, oh, well, you know, that's because you don't have this other $10,000 piece of equipment. They say, if you had that, it would obviously make this one, which we just sold you, and we didn't tell you needed this other one, would work so much better. So needless to say, they are not high in my list of people I recommend anymore.
Yeah.
So that transparency absolutely sets you apart. And I think, you know, you've really won over many of the people in the industry with your looking for openness for collaboration, as well as, hey, you tell us what you need. Unlike these other companies, which just came in and said, here's our stuff, buy it.
Yeah. I will say, I do like to just, as much as I like to make things very quickly, I will just maybe just like to make a minute to talk with your listeners about the process first to make something.
Yeah.
It does take time. Unfortunately, there's many good ideas out there that we do listen to and that are on our radar or that we've prototyped. But it's one of the lessons I've learned in manufacturing is when I started here, I wanted to, okay, we can get this turned around right away.
Yeah.
But I realized was that if customers want there to be parts available, if they want them to be replicable in the future, then it's one thing to prototype something and make one of something. We can do that really quickly.
Yeah.
It's another process, a whole nother layer to then produce it and manufacture it. And so that's sometimes, I think, maybe sometimes us as farmers, or, you know, as me as a grower who may not have fully understood the manufacturing process, there's another layer in there that we sometimes forget about.
Yeah.
So I always like to temper people's timelines a little bit with from the idea concept to the finished product.
Yeah. Well, and you're not a charity either. You have to make a money as a business to stay in business. So that means you can't just take every idea and make it, because you got to make sure that the demand is there for it.
That's right. That's correct.
So I know that's one of my frustrations with some things I want. And then it's like, oh, this is just like so unique to what I want. It just doesn't make sense on a larger scale.
Yeah.
And people can find out best information on Tilmore.com, on your social media, anywhere else they can find your info. You have a YouTube channel too.
We do. Once again, I'm not really good on all those, but yes, we have a YouTube channel, Tilmore Products, Tilmore, and Instagram, YouTube, Facebook. Our website, Tilmore.com, is one of the greatest places to get a hold of us and see our products.
Yeah.
And that's TILMOR.com.
Yes. And then on YouTube, that is Tilmore Products. Just type in Tilmore Products and it will pop right up. So, all right. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise and exactly, you know, how you build the company and just how that everything works in the background there. So thank you again for your time.
Thanks, Michael. It's been great talking with you today, and also just getting to know you over the last couple of years as well. So
absolutely.
Thanks for all you do.
Thank you. Farmers, next week on the show, we have Dennis Morsom, who is the founder of Microfarm DuPont-Say in Belgium. And I believe that's how you pronounce it. Sorry, guys, if I got it a little bit wrong. So Dennis is joining us to talk all about their very interesting farm-to-table concept. So what they've got is they've got a large greenhouse where they do a lot of the year-round growing. They have some fields. The greenhouse is heated by a biochar heater, which makes biochar as a waste product, which they then use in the farm as well. And then all of this, a lot of the production is actually processed into ready-to-eat meals, which are either delivered or people purchase through the on-farm store. So fascinating concept. Really can't wait for you guys to join me and hear about it and just how they've set this all up in such a short time. So there you have it, another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.